The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan's big electric switch. Scrappage is now available on your old car when you switch to a 100% electric Nissan Leaf.
Now, let's turn to the macroeconomic costs. People have shied away from sort of trying to put a number or a figure on the economic impact, quite separate to the public health issues, with our overall shutdown. We're going to discuss this now, both nationally and internationally, with Professor Alan Barrett, Chief Executive Officer of the ESRI, who have just published their spring quarterly economic commentary. It makes chilling reading. Their best assessment now is that in 2020, Ireland Inc. will shrink by 7% this year. Bear in mind, we've been enjoying growth of 3 or 4% each year for the last 7 years, the highest in the Eurozone. And we'll have David McWilliams, economist, broadcaster and presenter of the David McWilliams podcast, about explaining to us how we're going to get this helicopter money out and how all, because I actually don't understand how we can just go on and on and on printing more money and nobody seems to have to pay for it. All right, Alan, let's start with you. What's in your report and forecast, please?
Okay, well, I suppose the first thing to say is that this is not really a forecast. I mean, ordinarily, when the ESRI produces its quarterly economic commentary, we are trying to give a stab of what's actually going to happen in the economy. But obviously, this is, you know, way too difficult a task at this particular time. So really what we've tried to do here is work through a sort of a scenario and ask the question, well, what would be the economic impacts of a particular scenario? So what we've done is imagine the situation that the current restrictions that we're all living through lasts for about a 12-week period. And imagine at the end of that 12-week period, okay, when sort of things start opening again and life begins to return to normal, that there's a relatively quick bounce back. Okay, so we're trying to quantify the impact just of that 12-week. We don't know if it's going to go on for longer. We don't know a whole load of things, but we're just trying to, you know, get a quantification of that. So the way we've done it is we've sort of taken sort of consumption numbers to begin with. So we know from the CSO, like how many, much money do people spend on a whole variety of things, including all the sort of things they can't do at the moment. And then we've sort of taken the fact that so many people are becoming unemployed, and we've just tried to put it all together. And as you say, the results are quite stark. So just to give one or two headlines on this, we think unemployment could go from the relatively low levels of 5% from, you know, essentially about a month ago, up to about 18% by the time we hit the summer. That translates into about 300,000 job losses, which is just simply staggering. We've done our best to try and work out what would that do for the government's finances. So again, they were sort of close to balance. A small surplus had been the expectation. It's very easy to see the budget deficit going up to about 5% of GDP. But as I said, these are stark numbers.
Sorry, put a monetary figure on 5% of GDP?
No, I can't work it off the top of my head. Was it about 15 billion or something like that?
Yeah, I was thinking that. So a deficit from a break even to a profit to a minus 15 billion.
Exactly. And even to put that 5% of GDP in context, I mean, again, under the things like the European Union fiscal rules, all of which will have been completely forgotten about now and quite correctly, you know, the way you were in trouble, for example, if your deficit was over 2% of GDP. You know, so there's a whole host of things that are just coming at us now that are obviously unprecedented. The last thing I'll say is unemployment has been, you know, very, very high in Ireland previously, as in sort of, you know, 15-16% if you go back to the 1980s, around 15% of the last crisis. But what's extraordinary here is the speed of the adjustment. Okay, ordinarily your unemployment rate can go up, but not in such a concentrated time. And then the very last thing I'll say is one of the reasons that we're having this unusual spike is that in every other recession that Ireland has experienced, people could emigrate and go elsewhere. That is just one adjustment path that doesn't exist this time around.
Okay, comparing this to 2008-2010 crash, it's indelibly etched in my mind. 43,000 businesses went under, 177,000 construction workers lost their job, property values halved. Could you compare and contrast the kind of residual knock-on impacts on asset values, on different things? Or do you see this as being completely different? It's like a cash-starved 12 weeks or even 16 weeks, but mightn't have that sort of profound legacy effect. Or does the cash shortage mean that there will be legacy issues, you know, when people are doing their end-of-year accounts, including the national budget?
Yeah, I think one of the, so again, the imponderables is this issue of the length of time that this lasts. So let me give you a one of the differences between this time round and the last time round. So the last time round, to a certain extent, the difficulties began within the economy itself. Okay, so we had this remarkable overborrowing on the case of a whole load of people. We had a classic bubble economy, and then once that collapsed, we had the collateral damage, and of course there was a lot of people where asset values were wiped away. We had the banking difficulties and a whole sort of series of issues that began within the economy itself. The difference this time round is the difficulty is coming into sort of a relatively strong economy, and of course the difficulty is from outside the economy. It's a health crisis that's having all these sort of impacts. So if it is the case then that our benign scenario, that there can be a relatively rapid turnaround, okay, and if it was this notion that you were just going to shut everything off for a few weeks, you can imagine a situation in which those businesses are just about, the period will be such that they'll be able to reignite where this all to go away over the summer and things were to happen. And again, some of the policies that are now being introduced, this idea of paying wage subsidies to keep people connected to firms and everything like that, that's really, really sensible policy, and it's kind of trying to cling on to the economic fabric so that, you know, if this is relatively short, things can move on. I think the problem is that the longer this drags on, the more difficult you have the type of scenarios that you're talking about, whereas businesses die, people are out of work for a prolonged period of time. And again, then you start getting the sort of, let me describe it as sort of the scarring then starts emerging, and it takes longer thereafter then to get back. So, you know, these really are the sort
What I'm taking from that is that we have to have a national inflection point whereby we can see the bounce back and say it's okay to go back to work, it's okay, and whenever that will be will determine the cost. David McQuaid, please stay with us, Alan. David, we've discussed before, and I get your point, you need a liquid infusion of cash from central banks and government to keep the wheels turning, and we get all that. What I don't understand is this. So, if the government, 15 billion was just mentioned there by Alan, borrows that, I understand that, it's less tax coming in, it's more spending going on. But when I read of the Fed and Trump putting 2 trillion in, when I hear the ECB putting 750 billion in, whoever repays that money, do they just get a printing press?
Ivan, how are you? Alan, how are you? Ivan, nobody repays it. This is the alchemy of central banking. I'll give you an example. The British just paid off the last war bond from the First World War. They issued a 100-year bond in 1914, 1918, and they paid it off after 100 years. This is the sort of thing you can do in a crisis, Ivan. So basically, nobody will pay off the QE that the Fed and the European Central Bank have just announced. That, I know, is difficult for people to get their head around because they think, how come money is not being paid back? But ultimately, the economy and the central bank doesn't have a balance sheet in the same way as a commercial bank or a business. So if you think, most of the time you think about money and balance sheet size, and you think about there's credit on one side and debit on the other. Now, this is the sort of the tyranny of accountancy. It's actually very little to do with economics, particularly monetary economics. So step back and think, if the British could issue a bond in 1918 that was only paid back last year in full, it's called a consol, this is what you can do in a crisis. So the government comes in, borrows money, and I think the most important thing, Ivan, I think maybe Alan, I don't know what you think of this, is that this pandemic cannot lead to austerity, okay? And by that I mean this pandemic cannot lead to a massive spike in government debt, necessitating at some stage in the future, Ivan, an austerity budget or a series of austerity budgets, nor can this pandemic be seen as something that drives up government deficit, so much so that we can't in the future, when it passes, pay for schools and hospitals and housing and infrastructure. So I think you've got to look at this as a totally unique moment where economics comes
David, I just don't understand. Sorry, I get your point. What I don't understand is this. Say David McWilliams rings me up and he said, I'm strapped for cash, give me 100 euros, Ivan. At some point, someday, David has got to pay back Ivan 100 euros. If the government, it's the same. My question is this. If the ECB or the Fed just print money, surely you've devalued the currency. There must be some balance equation.
Well, the interesting thing is if they both print money at the same time, both currencies will have to devalue against something else. Who isn't printing money? And at the moment, there is no candidate for that, if you think about it, Ivan. If both central banks are printing money, both are actually relatively undermining their currency. Sure, the currency will adjust, okay? And that may be where you see it. But come back to the basic idea that if money is printed today, and if the government issues long-term debt, I actually believe the government of Europe will eventually end up issuing 50-year, 100-year debt at zero interest rate coupon. And they will be taken up either by the private sector as a sort of deposit in euros, or it will be all bought by the ECB. Okay? And this is the alchemy of central banking. In a way, being able to do this, Ivan, is the reward for good central banking over the last 4 or 5 or 6 decades, right?
Just stop there. Business bulletin that I've listened to for the last 3 or 4 years has said, oh no, Draghi is doing more quantitative easing, more bond buying. Surely priming this pump in good times.
Again, Ivan, I come back, right? Let's come back to the basic idea, right? The basic idea is that a central bank doesn't have a balance sheet like a commercial bank. Okay, it doesn't need to have assets on one side and liabilities on the other. Why? Because it is charged with the awesome power of printing money. Now, this is a huge, huge, huge power that central banks very rarely use. If you look at all central banks, they are all, and I've trained as a central banker, you're cautioned against printing money because of inflation and because of undermining the currency and because of undermining trust in the currency, right? So you do this for many, many years, okay? You try and do as sort of conservative as possible, okay? Then when you hit a crisis like now, a monumental crisis, you have the firepower. You have the firepower to actually act. All that's missing now is the courage to do so. And if you see what the ECB did last night and the ECB did last Thursday they announced this $750 billion, okay? But there were sort of caveats around it, and there were the usual terms and conditions apply. Because in the end, it's actually lending to other banks, okay, and governments. Last night, they basically looked at the terms and conditions and said, you know what, they don't really apply this time. We will go in and do whatever it takes. So I know conceptually, Ivan, that if you're thinking about a business and a balance sheet, it seems a little bit unusual, right? But I come back to the very, very serious point. This is why central bankers have tried to be independent of governments for the last 100 years, because the reward for having a strong central bank is during a crisis, that central bank has the trust and the confidence of the people to do the right thing. Contrast this, for example, with a country like Venezuela, a country like Zimbabwe, a country like Argentina, that actually pump-primed the economy using printing money in normal times. It now doesn't have the trust of the nation. So the minute Argentinians see central banks buying bonds, they sell their currency because they know we've seen this before. Whereas we in Europe, I think rightly now, have that huge confidence that the central bank is not going to debase the currency over a long time. And come back to Alan's point, which is our assumption and our working assumption has to be, Ivan, this is a 3 or 4 month issue. Now, if it goes on and if it rolls, then of course you've got serious problems because, as you said, logically, the only reason you can't keep printing money is if you generate inflation down the road. But we have been hit with a once-in-a-lifetime deflationary shock, not an inflationary shock. And the way you combat deflation is through inflation. And the way you generate inflation is you sustain demand through money.
All right, Alan, is it as simple as that?
I think it is. I mean, just to pick up a couple of the points, I mean, the first is, and this is the one David made, I think, at the outset of his remarks, that when we move into recovery mode or potential recovery mode, one of the things that will really, really slow things down would be a debt hangover. Okay, so one example of this, some discussion at the moment around this idea, well, what the government needs to do is extend loans to SMEs and businesses and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. The problem is that if SMEs are straddled with debt, I mean, you know, extra loans might keep them going in the short term, but not many companies are going to want to be carrying a huge amount of debt as they move forward. So that could be a really bad idea. And then if it's government debt that's going to accumulate, which may well happen absent the helicopter money, but if it's government debt, well, people are going to look at government debt and a number of things are going to happen. One is that the interest rates that governments are going to be charged may well start increasing, and that would be a drag on the economy. But the other thing is that everybody in a society, if you know the government is carrying huge amounts of debt, you might start anticipating that there will be higher taxes down the road. And so anybody looking ahead then is going to sort of going to be more cautious. So debt could act as a real serious drag on our ability to get out of this. On the helicopter money, I mean, I enjoyed your conversation with David there on the logistics of that, but he is absolutely right. Okay, just believe him, Ivan. The central bank, the European Central Bank, whoever, could do this at a stroke of a pen. I have to say, I mean, for the first few days of all these sort of discussions, instinctively, and I think David will again understand this, as an economist, instinctively, you react negatively to the notion of printing money because you do think of Mugabe and all of these sort of things. But the longer
I sort of sat around, but again,
picking up David's points, and he probably makes them much better than I could do. But that notion that as long as this is a once off, okay, the credibility of the European Central Bank is still intact. And likewise, if it's done on a sort of a transnational basis, so that you don't have relative devaluations of currency one to the other. So I have to say, I have come around to this notion in the last few days of thinking, yes, maybe this is actually the way to go.
Okay.
There's always a question mark around the precise logistics. And if I can just make one small point on this, for a lot of people at the moment, I mean, giving them money may not do an awful lot, for the economy in the immediate term, because there's actually nothing to spend your money on. But the confidence it will give and the sort of the avoidance of the debt overhang, I think, is now, quite persuasive.
All right.
And yes, it might be a risky strategy, but not doing it.
David,
is very risky.
I'm completely out of time. Just so that I understand it, the six different prime ministers, including Leo and Macron, have called for euro bonds.
Yes.
That is the vehicle that you're talking about, is it?
That is one of the vehicles. My preferred solution is much more simple, which is the central bank just simply issues a check to every government without actually the worry about bonds and bond trading and debt ratios, and actually just monetizes for this period and says, this is a one-off period. We built up credibility. The reason we build up credibility is for moments like this. We are going to act, and we just simply pay for everything. The central bank puts everything on its own balance sheet. It doesn't affect the debt ratios of any country, and we move on into the second half of the year, maybe into autumn, hopefully recovering, and this then will become remembered as a time when economics actually stepped up to the plate.
All right, my thanks indeed to David McWilliams and Professor Alan Barrett. Just get the COVID cash out of the vaults in the ECB. Thank you both. We'll have Evelyn with the good news of the weather in springtime next.